Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Thank you for coming to the Tattered Cover on Colfax. We really appreciate your support of our authors and our support of our independent bookstore. It is a pleasure to introduce Carrie LeSueur, who is the author of The Home Place. This is a debut novel, and it is a wonderful book. And I'm going to read a quote by Wiley Cash, who's also new novelist and now a New York Times bestselling novelist of The Land More Kind Than Home and Dark Road to Mercy. He says of The Home Place, "Like thin ice on the face of a frozen lake, once this novel is cracked open, it'll pull you in and dare you to come up for air. In Alma Terrebonne, Carrie LeSueur has forged a heroine who's just as smart as her creator. The Home Place is a lot of things, a mystery, a crime drama, a family saga, and most importantly, a very, very good book." Please welcome Carrie LeSueur.
Thank you very much, Lisa. I'm so glad to be here before this great crowd. Montana has, of course, a glorious worldwide reputation for places like Glacier National Park and the Rocky Mountains. And so it's this this beautiful touristy scene in most people's minds. And that's certainly part of the landscape of The Home Place. So it's a beautiful place, but the reason we're there is much more about family. And the Home Place turns in its focus away from the Rockies and the more touristed part of the state toward the plains and eastern Montana and the sagebrush and butte country, the sugar beet fields. But the Home Place is about this land east of Billings, which gets less attention, and I think even in state politics is considered less valuable than what's to the west, where the tourists come. And so it's where the coal comes from. So that's my law practice. I work for farmers and ranchers and tribal members who are faced with really runaway fossil fuel extraction in eastern Montana. And there's a shot. Yeah, there's one here that has some flags along the ground, and these are actually archaeological surveyors' flags that are showing pieces they found in a lithic scatter. And this is part of an environmental impact statement that's being done for the proposed Tongue River Railroad, which would run coal out of an entirely new coal strip mine called the Otter Creek Tracts. So I'm representing landowners who are threatened with being crossed by condemnation for this railroad, a route of about 40 miles to bring them up to the BNSF branch line, and also representing a group of Northern Cheyenne who are resisting the mine itself because there are ancestral homelands there that haven't been properly protected. And this is just a way of life in eastern Montana for many decades and to this day, resisting the steamroll of fossil fuel projects. So the Home Place is really about place, and that's what a lot of the reviews say. It takes you very much into a specific place in eastern Montana that I happen to know very well and is a part of my family for many generations. It's the story of Alma Terrebonne, who's a lawyer in Seattle. She comes from Billings and Bighorn County, where the family home place is, and has tried to block out that history. She left home to go to college when she was 17 after her parents died in a car accident, and her sister was maimed and lost part of her leg, and her older brother was in the Marine Corps at the time but was a functional alcoholic and just couldn't take any responsibility for their younger sister at that point. So Alma ran away and struck out for herself, which is a taboo in her family. and really hasn't gone back. She was back once for her grandfather's funeral 5 years before, but she gets this call early one Sunday morning when she's in at the office, because that's what she does. And it's an officer with the Billings PD who says, someone has been found, and we think it's your sister, and we need you to come identify the body. And she catches the next flight and goes back to Billings, where everything is waiting. The family she left behind and relationships that she just cut off cold when she was 17, and her niece, Brittany, Vicky's daughter, who's 11. There's the question of what exactly happened to Vicky. She was found lying in the cold, possibly dead from exposure, possibly from something else. And Alma is trained as an attorney and decides she's got to find out what happened. So the real story arc of the book is about Vicky's murder and figuring out how all of those events took place. But there's a huge amount of personal development that Alma has to cram into about a week before she decides what she's going to do with Brittany. She runs into her high school sweetheart, Chance, who she cut off pretty much without a word 15 years ago. She goes to see her brother, Pete, who's now running a coffee house in Billings and is living a somewhat closeted relationship with his partner, Shep, which can be a difficult thing to this day in Billings, Montana. So I have a few pieces of the book just flagged to give you an idea of what it sounds like, what some of the story is. And I'll read you just a few paragraphs from the beginning. Sunday, 2 a.m. Mountain Standard Time. The cold on a January night in Billings, Montana, is personal and spiritual. It knows your weaknesses. It communicates with your fears. If you have a God, this cold pulls a veil between you and your deity. It gets you alone in a place where it can work at you. If you are white, especially from the old families, the cold speaks to you of being isolated and undefended on the infinite homestead plains. It sounds like wolves and reverberates like drums in all the hollow places where you wonder who you are and what you would do in extremis. In this cold, you understand at last that you are not brave at all. If you're Indian, a Crow or Cheyenne off the res, maybe, a Shoshone, Hidatsa, Assiniboine, one of the humbled peoples of an unforgiving land, the cold will sound different, but still it knows your name. It has no mercy for you, no matter how long and intimate its relationship with your mothers and fathers. You, of all people, ought to know it is a killer. How many of your relatives has it taken? More than wars and car crashes? Do your fingers and toes tingle in the cold because of some childhood frostbite before you learn to cover up, or when the power company turned off the juice and your little back got pushed up hard against the cold rock of winter? And we also meet early on Brittany, who's 11 years old, and she's been trailing along in her mother Vicky's wake for all her life, as Vicky has struggled to manage through a series of minimum wage jobs and a lot of struggle with drugs and alcohol. And we come across Brittany this same night and learn a little about some of her coping mechanisms after Vicky wanders out the front door Brittany tries to call her back, and Vicky's gone and won't listen. Brittany peeks around the door jamb toward the beer drinker, who has fallen asleep again. She creeps along the edge of the living room back to the bedroom, where she finds the heaviest coat in the pile. Then she sneaks back out to the living room and again maneuvers herself onto the back of the couch pushed against the front window. The chill comes straight through the single pane. Brittany wraps the coat more tightly around herself and stares out for as long as she can stay awake. She thinks she sees headlights down the street, but they don't come as far as the house. If it were Pete, he'd come for her, jog up the steps in his businesslike way, sweep into the house with that steadiness like he's on land and Kaczynski and all his pals are swaying on a ship's deck. If she can't have Pete, Brittany wishes that her invisible dog, Burrow, were here. Climbing up the way he used to, nearly unbalancing the couch with his weight to lie down along the length of its back next to her. She can almost see him, almost feel his smelly, doggy warmth. For just a moment, Brittany allows herself to caress Burrow's head and ask him to shift her mother's steps, just enough, towards safety. Brittany is too old for Burrow. People have made clear that this is childish foolishness. Burrow padded off when she was 7 or 8. But she still thinks of him, still knows he's real, even though she doesn't talk about him anymore. Tonight, unexpectedly, here he is. Burrow lifts his head to show his empathic brown eyes and nudges his licorice black nose into her hand. The warm solace fills her, makes her sleepy. We also get to know Alma's relationship with Vicky pretty well, even though Vicky's gone. It's a real trip back into Alma's own regrets about that relationship and her inability to be the missing mother that Vicky needed when they lost their parents at 12. And one of the first things Alma has to do when she gets back to Billings is go to the morgue and identify the body. The room he lets her into is nothing but a small antechamber to an office with an autopsy room beyond. Alma tries not to look through to the steel examination table and the instruments arrayed beside the sinks and along the walls, but they draw her eyes. It's impossible not to feel like a voyeur. She wants to look everywhere at once, to stare. Larry seems not to notice. He offers Alma a low plastic chair, then unlocks the heavy steel door that guards the cooler. As he swings open the door, a smell drifts out, like Alma's high school biology classroom on the day they dissected frogs, not strong, but evocative. She threw up in one of the lab sinks that day. Now she sits still and is thankful for the chair. Larry rolls out a steel gurney with a thick black pad. On top lies a heavy blue bag. He locks the gurney wheel, stands next to the head, and gestures for Alma to stand opposite him. "I'll unzip the shroud enough to see her face, and all you have to do is nod yes or no," he says. He waits until Alma is in position, looks her over to be sure she's steady, then opens the shroud. Vicky's face is clean. Someone has wiped away the rest of the blood that still crusts at the edge of her mouth and combed her long dark hair. Her features are a little puffy, bruised by post-mortem lividity, but it's definitely her. All the Hopkins and Terrebonne genes pooled in her high cheekbones and long nose, so like Alma's that sometimes they could pass as each other with strangers when they were younger, even though Alma is 5 years older. The resemblance is strongest beside a campfire, when the low light draws out their bone structure. This is Alma's face, herself, the but for the grace of God scenario. She mouths the words, "There but for the grace of God go I." She has repeated them to herself many times as a talisman against hubris, and always when she says them, she thinks of Vicky, that other self, living out the bitter, addictive abandon that is the flip side of Alma's compulsive work ethic and white-knuckled self-control. We get to know Pete a little better and Grandma Maddie and her connection to the home place and the land out Sarpy. But there's a moment that that Alma realizes that things have changed around the home place in ways that she hadn't understood. And this is part of the drama that's going on back home that she gets pulled into in spite of all her intentions to just regulate back in Montana and go back to Seattle. She's out riding with her old friend Chance and his small daughter and Brittany, and they've taken a trail they know very well across Chance's family land. Chance strikes out to the east along a path Alma remembers, taking them toward another vista from which she knows the ranch land will unroll for many miles, unbroken to the brown horizon, heart-stopping at sunrise. The horses jog along, breathing steam like dragons. May chatters at her father about a fox that crossed their path on the last ride. Now Brittany lags behind, watchful. Alma and Lulabelle gain the viewpoint first. Alma raises her eyes from her horse to the eastern horizon and cannot stifle a sharp shriek. "Chance," she cries, "what is that?" In the middle distance, a black crater covers several square miles of the ranch land, Alma remembers. Machinery moves across it so visibly at this great distance that it must be Brobdingnagian up close. Great clouds of black dust rise and float on a northwest wind, dark portents over spoil piles extending south along the valley in knobby, regular hills. Haul roads trace the land like new, dirty veins. The creek and trees that used to traverse the valley are entirely gone. "This is what's been going on the last 2 years," Chance turns his back into the wind to shelter May. "They're trying to expand in our direction. Sometimes we can feel the blasts all the way over at our place." "Whose land is this?" "Most of it that they're on now is either BLM land or the Gingrich place who got it from the railroad. It all passed to the kids out of state, so they just sold off the mineral rights. Never even talked to the neighbors, and the feds don't care what we think. Now the landmen are leaning hard on folks who own the next tracts they want so they can mine straight across to tribal land. It cost them a fortune to dismantle these drag lines and start up on a new site." "The Crow are letting them mine?" Chance squints in the direction of the reservation to the southwest and nods with cold eyes. "Tribal government can't sign the contracts fast enough. All they see is dollar signs, and the historic preservation office is as crooked as they come." Alma is trembling. She turns her face away from the view and nudges Lulabelle back down the trail, the others descending with her out of the wind. As they step down onto level ground again, she feels Lulabelle straining at the reins, wanting to run. And Alma opens her arms and lets her. She knows how wrong, how rude it is to ride away from the others, but her whole soul is stretched out in flight, like Lulabelle's, unharnessed, unhinged. Together they flee the horror behind them, stretched out, hearts pounding. Lulabelle answering the tremors in Alma's body with flight, with blessed escape, running flat out for both of them on the smooth old stock trail, light hooves skimming the frozen earth in a cadence like skin drums. They flee together as Alma weeps, back toward the Little M, Chance, May, and Brittany trailing far behind. A quarter mile or so short of the barn, Alma reins in Lulabelle. It will never do to let her run all the way in. Alma glances over her shoulder at the others far up on the ridge and drops her head, mortified at her loss of control. And that's what I have marked for tonight. I'd be happy to take questions. Yes, ma'am. Oh, just eternally. I've been working on this for about 10 years. So I'd rewritten it several times before I ever sent it out to anybody, and then went through a couple of major revisions with my agent, and then when it sold, went through another major revision with the editor. So I have a friend who read a very, very early version of it, probably 8 years ago, and it will be unrecognizable to him when he reads the final product. I think it got better, and it wasn't, there wasn't any arm twisting involved. It was very, very productive, suggestions. Like I'd like to know what's going on with this character and understand better where this person is coming from, or these events seem a little hurried up. Can you spell this out? Or, give us more about this and flesh out the story so that we understand better. So that was, it was less telling me how to write it than asking me to give more, which was really a big help. And then of course there was a copy editor, and I had never worked with a professional copy editor, and they're geniuses. It's just an art form, and they fix things you didn't know were wrong. Well, I find out next week. We've gotten, actually, the very first bookseller review that we got was from Barbara Tarot at Fact and Fiction in Missoula. And Fact and Fiction is doing a really nice lunch event next week. So they've been great and huge supporters. And there are a lot of Montana writers who are just really supportive of each other. So that's been a wonderful community to get to know. Thank you very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Foden. We have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.